morning and welcome to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. Maybe you've been up north to Weston or out east to Herman, or maybe just to your local grocery store aisle. Wherever it was, there's a good chance you've had the opportunity to sample Missouri wine. Show Me State may not have all the same types of old world grapes or top dollar wineries, but producers here are doing innovative and creative things, and at least some people think they're making a name for themselves in the larger wine world. Today, we offer a look at Missouri wines along with a few global counterparts. Maybe you can find one to enhance your late summer party or to complement your dinner or make a nice gift for that out-of-town guest. How does Missouri compare with Italy and Australia and Austria? Well, joining us today to help answer that question is our regular expert on wine, our master sommelier and master of wine, Doug Frost. Welcome, Doug.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you.
It's great to see you again. It's been a while.
Yeah, a little too long. I've been on the road too much, I think.
Tell us where you've been.
Well, actually, I was just up in Traverse City. I snuck up there for the film festival, but because, you know, I'm me,
because
I have to visit wineries too.
Fair enough.
And found great wine. I mean,
is Michigan wine good wine?
Yeah, there's actually some great wine. I still argue that the single best Pinot Blanc I've ever had in my life, which is an Alsace and an Italian grape, is a Left Foot Charlie Pinot Blanc from actually from the old Mission Peninsula by Traverse City.
Well, we'll see today if Missouri wine can stand up to the high standards that Traverse City, Michigan has set for us.
I think they will.
Well, very good. Let's see if we can address that question head on. Let's get this out on the table right away. Missouri wine, not necessarily the best reputation. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's certainly fair. I think that that people's expectations of high quality wine are that they come from established areas like Bordeaux, Burgundy, certain areas of Italy, certain areas of Germany and Spain, and the rest of old Europe, and that it, when it comes to the New World, there's a handful of places in Australia, there's Washington and Oregon, and then there's the 800-pound gorilla, California. At least it's the big gorilla in the U.S. marketplace where it controls the vast majority of the wines that are sold or produces those wines.
But places like Missouri.
Yeah, I think we have as long a history, in fact, a more successful 19th century history of grape growing and winemaking than California did. California's eminent success, frankly, in the 19th century was disrupted by a disease that took hold of the Anaheim, the vast Los Angeles vineyards, because indeed that's where most wine in California came from up until about the 1880s or so. And what precipitated the move up to Napa and Sonoma really was this a disease called Pierce's disease, and it's still a problem. It's a big problem in Texas right now, although the Texans in good Texas fashion are still boasting that they're great, it's going to be fine, and we're going to be, we have no problem, but that Pierce's disease is really looming around the corner. So it destroyed Los Angeles. Everybody moved up to Napa and Sonoma during this whole time. Places like Missouri and Ohio in particular were making vast amounts of wine. I mean, we're talking a million or more cases of wine a year, and selling it quite successfully on the East Coast, generally speaking, where the population centers were. Prohibition put an end to many, many wine endeavors throughout the country, and Missouri was not the least amongst them. So it was very slow to recover. And the truth of the matter is that the rise of California and the West Coast happened commensurate with the rise of the success of making vinifera grapes and growing vinifera grapes and making vinifera wine. Now, vinifera is just a species, basically, and it has subtypes that we call Chardonnay and Cabernet and Zinfandel and Merlot, and those are the famous grapes of the old world. Those do really well in coastal on the West Coast, but certainly on the East Coast as well. You get to the Midwest, and they just can't survive our hot summers, our humid summers, and our super cold winters.
So as we get to some of the particular wines today, maybe you can walk us through how the grapes are different and why it's different than what we might find in those more familiar varietals. We should get tasting, but before we do that, let me introduce the people who are at the table doing the tasting this morning. We've got the entire up-to-date production team shows up on these days. It's really interesting. Danny Alexander, our producer, is here. Good morning, Danny.
Good morning, Brian.
And also Lisa Rodriguez, our assistant producer. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Our associate producer, pardon me. and then also David Fulk has joined us out of the business office. He's our director of philanthropic giving here at KCUR. Good to see you, David.
Thanks very much.
All right, so this is our expert crew. Doug, let's go ahead and get started. What are you pouring first?
Well, first I'm cracking open a bottle of Grüner-Veltliner. Grüner-Veltliner is the name of the grape. It's the most widely planted grape in Austria. And it's a little bit off the beaten path these days, although Grüner-Veltliner is doing really well. It just keeps growing and growing in popularity in the U.S. market. And this is, I brought this grape sort of, and this wine sort of purposely in so much as I think that what's changing, what's opening the field for Missouri wines, Kansas wines, wines made from grapes other than the big famous names that we're familiar with, is that the big famous names we're familiar with aren't so important anymore. Chardonnay is still doing very well. It's still the number one grape. Cabernet is still doing well. It's still the number one red grape. But we're seeing grapes like Moscato, which nobody had even heard of a few years ago, enter the ranks of the top five. We're seeing grapes like Albarino from Spain. The U.S. has become the single most important market for Albarino, a Spanish grape that 10 years ago you couldn't get arrested, trying to find in the U.S. And Grüner-Veltliner is much the same category if the Austrians didn't drink so darn much of it.
Grüner-Veltliner.
Grüner-Veltliner.
G-R-U-N-E-R. Okay.
And then the second word is Veltliner. So it's a grape that is, generally speaking, I think just produces a nice, crisp white wine. What makes it special, or at least what makes us in the industry think that it's special, is it's capable of aging. And white wines, often, we think of as not really capable of aging. Mm-hmm. I would have to kind of point a bony finger at California to say, look, in general, California white wine is not age-worthy. There are a few exceptions, of course, but in general, if you have a 5-year-old California Chardonnay, you need to drink it. If you have a 3-year-old California Sauvignon Blanc, you need to drink it. This is a Grüner-Veltliner from the 2012 vintage, so it's already 3 years old.
Huh.
And I'd say, you know, if you have this wine, this is from a place called Domaine Vacau, really beautiful old building with cellars that date back to the 17th century and covered in mold in the basement and such. It's really, really a cool place. Mm. If I drink one of these wines when they're 10 or 20 years old, I'm often drinking a wine that is still in very good shape.
So let me ask Danny Alexander, you've had your first sip of the Grüner-Veltliner.
Or maybe two. the first question I had was, can a white age in the bottle, or can it only age in a cask?
Oh, no. Definitely can age in the bottle. So this
has a bit of complexity. Just the first thing was the nose hit me right away. Mm-hmm. And I went, oh, mm-hmm. This has got a little more than just usually with a white wine, it has like a single note in the nose for me. But this has a little bit more, and I absolutely love the balance of it. I really, really do.
Yeah. What do you think, Lisa?
I love it. And for the record, I said I was going to spit, and I didn't.
So busted.
So keep listening by the end of the hour to Lisa's comments then.
But I think it's delicious and really crisp and delightful. I like it, and it was surprising to me.
I was expecting, and I think probably just because of the name, I thought of German wines, I thought of things like Gewürztraminer. I was expecting something much sweeter and not nearly... This is much more of a summer day, spring, nice outdoor wine, it feels like to me. But what do you think, David?
Well, I'm from Weston, and people spit up there, but never alcohol or wine. And I, like you, Brian, was thinking Gewürztraminer, and this is nothing like that. This has a very pleasant tartness to it that I like a lot.
Yeah, it is definitely a tart wine. It is certainly true that, in general, the Austrians like their white wines nice and tart. They see them as food wines. You think about some of the classic Austrian food. It can, whether we're talking about schnitzel or a sausage or things like that, you know, there's a lot of oiliness that's potential there. Mm-hmm. You need some tartness to kind of clean that up and make the food taste better. And that's just the way they drink. They make a lot of Riesling, but they typically make it dry. And the amazing thing to me is exactly as you said, Brian, you know, this is a wine that it comes off nice and crisp and clean, be fun to make it nice and cold and drink it on a hot afternoon. But as Danny was alluding to, there's a little something extra going on there that isn't really showing up just yet. It's kind of in the background. We come back to this wine in 3 or 4 or 5 years, there's going to be more other stuff. And that other stuff is kind of undefinable because it's probably a bit personal or, you know, odd, or we begin to talk about notes like mineral, whatever the hell heck that is. You know, I did just say whatever the hell that is because it's really true. Right.
What does a rock taste like, really? How do I know?
Well, actually, I'm a rock licker. You know, we do that in the wine business. We'll pick up a rock and
we're learning some new things about you today, Doug.
You know, it's just it's really funny. Actually, I can tell the story of a guy I'm trying to visit in a couple weeks. He's a Washington winemaker who we visited one of his new wineries and vineyards, and the rocks were incredible. I mean, it was just like, and I just tasted the wines, and this was new stuff. And I picked up a rock, and I said, you know, this rock literally smells like your wine. He said, oh, taste it. He's French, okay? So I taste it. You know, I lick the rock, and I'm like, oh my God, it really does remind me of that wine. He's like, oh, it's incredible. You know, we go to the next vineyard. I'm like, oh, these rocks too. Oh my God, Christophe, this is like that too. And then we went to a new vineyard, and the soil was kind of humusy. And he holds it up, and I said, oh, cool. And he said, no, taste this one. I'm like, okay, so I taste the dirt, you know, I'm like, okay, and it goes, you know what that tastes like? Worms. Stupid Frenchman. So, anyway, so it's a little silly that we lick rocks, but, you know, we're just trying to understand.
And if you're just joining us, you have no idea what in the world you've turned to, but that's Doug Frost. He's a master of wine and a master sommelier. He's our regular expert on wine here on Up to Date on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison, and we are tasting a variety of wines around the world today in an effort to ascertain what's going on with Missouri wine these days. So we are pouring our second glass of wine, and Doug, talk to us about what we're drinking next.
So this is a Missouri wine. This is a dry vignole. So it's a dry wine. It's made from the vignole grape, which is, I have to say, really the most exciting white grape in the Missouri, in Missouri vineyards right now. Although, I believe when you guys had me on last year, I probably said Valvin Muscat. And the year before that, I probably said Treminet.
Well, it doesn't have to be the same grape every year. That's exciting.
Yeah. I'm excited by different things. But I really just love what vignole can do. It has been sort of an uneven ripener. That's to say, you look at a cluster and you'll get like a grape that's really a little overripe. And then you look at the same cluster and you'll see a grape that's really green and not ripe enough yet. And so people weren't sure how to handle that. And people tended to make dessert wines out of it because it was a little easier to deal with the fact that you had all these, you know, different ripeness in the single cluster. So you didn't see a lot of dry vignole. And in the last 3 or 4 years, everybody started to dial it in. And so we're starting to see more dry vignole. This is from Noble Eyes Vineyard. And I really, let's put it this way. If I were trying to sort of stack the deck, I might have served this wine first because I didn't want to embarrass it by putting it up against a world-class, tart, crisp wine like this Austrian Grüneveltliner. But I feel significantly confident in these wines that I'm like, no, let's put it to the test. How does it taste after one of the, you know, the world's benchmark dry, crisp, tart wines?
Well, and that's let's ask that question. You, the three of you who've been sitting here drinking both of them. Lisa, you look ready to analyze this wine.
I was also surprised by this one. I definitely, you know, on the nose smelling it, I thought it was going to be sweeter. It definitely has a little more sugar than the last one, but I like it. I think it's fruity. Maybe I'm crazy. I'm tasting a lot of pear, but but I like this one a lot.
Doug is affirming your sense of the notes.
I think pear is definitely one of the big notes here.
I'm struck by also just Lisa's comments. I was expecting. It seems like a big part of what Missouri wines may not have going for them is what people are expecting, and then they find confirmation of what they were expecting rather than what they're actually tasting.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think that's sort of where we're at today, that those expectations are slowly being confounded, and that it's going to take a while, and that's okay. You know, really, it is that there's still a ton of Missouri wine out there that is sweet. One of the reasons for that is that a lot of these grapes tend to be very tart grapes. Mm-hmm. And you need actually some sweetness so the wine isn't unpleasantly undrinkable. So the great irony here is that a grape like Sauvignon Blanc is not as tart. A grape like Chardonnay is definitely not as tart in and of itself as a grape like Vignole or a grape like Sauvignon Blanc. So it has become the practice over the last half century or so, while we get used to these grapes, because a lot of these grapes are relatively new, it's become the practice to, well, make sure there's a little bit of sweetness to it to soften that. And winemakers are getting better at finding that balance point and frankly, vineyardists, you know, farmers are getting better at getting the grapes the proper ripeness.
Danny Alexander, what do you think?
I'm aware. This is I tend to have a thing lately for wines that would have the Vouray, Vonier, and I am aware of the Vignol, and I really do like this particular wine as a whole. And this in particular is, I'd stand it up next to, yeah. I would. Sorry, I'm kind of
she's in awe of the wine.
I am actually.
Can you spell it for us? Just for the listeners, Vignol.
Yeah, Vignol is a French American hybrid, and so the first name is V as in Victor, I G N as in Nancy, O L E S, Vignol. Although if you want to call it Vignolis, as I've heard it called a lot, you know, that's fine.
Vignolis.
We don't care.
However you spell it, we will put all of these wines that we're tasting today on our website, kcur.org. You can look for that later today.
And I will say that when it comes to a lot of times, because my French is so horrific, I will literally just spell it when I go into a store and say I'm looking for, and then just it's easier than me slaughtering it.
David Folk, your first Missouri wine of the day. What do you think?
Well, if it's Missouri wine, it must be overly sweet, right?
That's the expectation.
Well, this is very fruity, but it's not sweet.
Mm-mm.
Is that?
I agree.
But it's very nice.
It's lovely.
I think it's as successful an example of dry vignol as you'll find out there. There are actually others now. That's the really exciting thing. 3 years ago, I would have said, oh my gosh, look, I found this Noblized dry vignol. It's a great dry vignol. Today, I'm like, oh yeah, there's about 12 of them out there. They're really good. They're really solid.
And I actually like the finish on this better than on the first one.
Doug, where is this vineyard?
I was just going to ask that. Where is the Noblized vineyard? What do you know about it?
Well, this is Augusta. So a lot of our vineyards are right around the Augusta area. You know, we'll see some vineyards farther down south as well. A lot of times along the road that goes from Springfield to St. Louis, what is that, 44? But this is Augusta, and a lot of my favorite vineyards in Missouri are up that way.
Very good. We're talking today about Missouri wines and how they stand up to other wines. I think we'll hold off on the red wines until the second half of the show. But I did want to ask you, Doug. One of the things I've heard you say is that every wine has its person, or there's a wine for every person. That you got to just match the right taste to the right wine. Who is the person? What kind of taste is going to match well, do you think, with a local wine? Is that too difficult a question?
No, I think that's a really good question. I think that's the hinge point that we're at today. I think that this is really what's starting to happen, is that these wines are evolving and the customer is evolving. I think that the you know, Lisa, with all due respect, I would say, you know, your generation, my daughter's generation, they have an openness and they certainly have a greater awareness to wine than most in my generation had at an early age. And I'd say in general, less of an intimidation factor, more of a, hey, I like wine. You know, if I don't like it, I don't care. I'm not going to drink it. If I like it, I like it. You know, I don't care what it is and where it comes from. So, whereas people of my generation, like I can remember when my friend Andrea Emma Robinson did a book about wine, she wrote about 6 grapes. That was all she needed to cover the world of wine.
Yeah.
Which then, you know, like 2 years later, I did a book, I covered 100 grapes. So, you know, you can see where my mind was at on it. But the truth of the matter is now 100 isn't enough, because people, you know, younger people are not as intimidated, really are just expecting that it tastes good. And even to this point, no longer have the expectation that Missouri wine has to be sweet or that it's bad. Rather, the expectation that they're going to have to look a little bit harder to find one they like, because they know there's some that are sweet, there's some that are bad, there's some that are good, there's some that are dry. And, you know, sweet is good, too. I mean, I really have to say I love sweet wine, especially I eat really hot food, or at least I love to eat hot food, and nothing cools the fire like a little bit of sugar.
A lot of what I associate with Missouri wineries when I have visited them and I look at what they have available, some of it isn't even wine per se. They sell mead or something you might call a dessert wine, but it's raspberry based or something. What's up with that?
I think that there is a, you've got to run a business. So you've got to find products that you can sell. And in truth, particularly in Kansas has been very limited by the amount of acreage that's been devoted to grapes. Unhappily, the Kansas wineries then decided, well, then it's okay if we shop outside Kansas and blend non-Kansas wine into Kansas bottles. I think that's a dreadful thing, because in the the long term, you're not supporting the farmers that are going to support you. Missouri has been, I think, better about that in the main, but there's still not enough of that fruit to go around, and so people have to have other products to sell.
Well, let's take a break, but when we come back, we're going to talk with you, we hope. We want to hear what Missouri wineries you've visited and what Missouri wines you've tasted and enjoyed. What would you add to our list? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. You can also tweet at us. We are at KCUR up to date. What do you need to know from our Master of Wine and Master Sommelier, Doug Frost? When we return, he'll bring us more entries in this battle between Missouri and the rest of the world of wine. So stay with us. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske today. If you missed our conversation yesterday about Latinos in baseball or our look at a day in the life of school teachers, you can find those as well as all of our programs at kcur.org. Don't forget to join us tomorrow on the program. We'll take a look at combat-ready kitchens and also the world of wordless books. But today our guest is Doug Frost, the master of wine, master sommelier, our resident expert on wine, who's talking with us today about Missouri wines and how they hold up against wines from around the rest of the world. We'd love to have you in the conversation. If you have a question or a recommendation about Missouri wine, give us a call at 816-235-2888. You can also tweet at us. We're at KCUR up to date. We talked about white wines in the first half of the show. Doug Frost, introduce us to some reds.
Well, let's just go ahead and get started here, sort of put things in perspective. I was going to bring along a California wine, and at the last minute, I switched it out with an iconic Shiraz from Australia.
Oh, I know this one.
Yeah, to some degree, I switched it out because I think that Shiraz and Syrah do not get enough love right now. They were nutso in the marketplace 5 years ago. Yeah. And Malbec has sort of consumed and subsumed.
It's taking that spot.
Yeah, it really took that spot. And I love Malbec too, but I think that Shiraz / Syrah, same grape, different names, deserves a place at the table. And I often view it this way, that if you want to save money, if you want to get good value, you should go where no one else is going. And these days, that's thing grapes like Shiraz and Merlot offer, I think, better value than Pinot Noir, which once again replaced Merlot to a degree, and Malbec, which certainly replaced Shiraz.
So Shiraz, Syrah is a familiar enough grape for a lot of people. What should they be looking for when they're tasting a Shiraz?
It's a wonderful grape that functions in a variety of environments. In other words, there's a lot of grapes like Grüner Veltliner. You need to be in a relatively cool place. Riesling, you definitely need to be in a cool place. Shiraz or Syrah, cool site. White pepper, red cherry, sometimes leafiness, and strawberry and raspberry. Warm climate, black cherry, blackberry, black pepper. So it seems to function no matter wherever you plant the thing, and I think that's one of its lovely merits. This is a warmer site. This is South Australia, so this is going to be a warmer site. More about black cherry, blackberry, black pepper, things of that nature.
I don't know if you mentioned the particular wine we're drinking.
This is Penfolds, the very famous name from Australia, and this is their Canunga Hill Shiraz bottling, a 2013 bottling. And as you can see, I mean, if you've followed this wine at all, 5 years ago, Canunga Hill was pretty good. This is really good. I mean, this is like fat and thick and unctuous and I think pretty delicious. But here I've broken my rule. I'm supposed to let you guys talk about
right.
that.
Right. Well, I'm going to second that it's pretty delicious. David, you're grinning from ear to ear.
There's a wonderful smokiness to this, and which I didn't get in the smelling of it. But that taste, it's just...
It's very much the barrel. That's the wine has been put inside a toasted barrel, and a lot of people have recognized that a little bit of heavy toast on barrel, a little bit, not a lot, will give this kind of smoky coffee, mocha, cocoa sort of hint, not really aroma. Sometimes it goes too far. You can buy, actually right now, South African wines, and they'll literally say coffee barrel because they put so much of that toast on there. You pick up the wine, it smells like coffee grounds.
I smelled the oakiness of the barrel, but I tasted the smoke, and that was a nice surprise.
Huh. Okay, nodding her head is Lisa Rodriguez, associate producer of Up to Date.
Yeah, I'll echo what David said there, that when I smelled it, I got a lot of that fruit at the beginning, but when I tasted it, it was that pepperiness and smokiness, and that is what is lingering now for me afterwards. But I'm a fan.
Yeah, okay. And a producer of UpToDate, Danny Alexander.
I've actually been drinking this wine for quite a few years now. It's been a staple in my wine rack. So, but you're right, this is a very nice year for this. And I like this one because when it comes to tannin, to me, this has the right level for me. I don't mind my tongue going to the roof of my mouth, but I do like to be able to unglue it. So in this case, this is this has for me that just that right note.
Well, we have the wine for you coming up.
I'm wondering as we taste this, is there I imagine we're going to a Missouri wine here shortly, but is it fair to start talking about direct parallels? I think a lot of, in fact, I've had this experience in Missouri wineries where they will say, if you like Merlot, you'll like this Missouri grape that is not Merlot. If you like Cabernet Sauvignon, you'd probably like this Norton or whatever. Is that fair?
I think it is fair. I think it's very difficult for us to communicate flavor to each other. Imagine trying to tell somebody what an artichoke tastes like. Eventually, you'd run out of silly metaphors, and then you'd say, oh, just taste the damn thing, and you know you'll see. And I think wine is much the same way. I think we do a pretty bad job of explaining flavor in wine. I do what I can, and as I say, there are some schools of thought that think the way that I describe wine is silly. You know, coming up with all these fruit metaphors and that sort of thing. But I can say, look, the blackberry flavor, the compound that makes a blackberry is actually in this wine, in that Shiraz. That's why it smells and tastes like that. So I think trying to sell Missouri wine or Kansas wine or what have you by describing its similarity to a better-known California grape, nothing wrong with that. What I'm hoping for, or what I really do believe is the near future, is that we're going to see a time when people can just say, well, this is kind of a heavier grape. This is a lighter grape. And people say, oh, you mean like a Merlot? Well, you know, it's like a Merlot, but not. So I think eventually somebody will be able to say, this is like a Norton. Or this is like a Vignol. It's really just a matter of getting to know these grapes. And for now, people make comparisons to well-known grapes. But as I say, 10 years ago, a lot of the grapes that people are familiar with today weren't well-known. So I think things are changing.
We've got a lot of folks interested in weighing in on Missouri wines. One of those is Sean, who is joining us by phone. Sean, welcome to UpToDate.
Hi.
What are your thoughts about Missouri wine? One in particular?
Yes, I also got a tongue for sweet flavors, and my beginning with wine was sangria, but I sought out, you know, the best flavors that could provide a sweet wine for me, and I got into meads, and there's a Missouri company called Pirtle
yes,
Winery,
yes.
And they do an amazing blackberry mead.
I
get it
one.
Every time we go camping. It's very delicious.
You That's know, you're totally Weston, yeah. totally right. I've voted for that as a gold medal twice in a row because I'm one of the judges at the Missouri State Competition. That's just really, really good. Well, good base mead and then really good flavored mead. Yeah, Pirtle has, I think, you know, they've been around a long time, but I have to say it's only in the last 5 or 7 years that I've kind of wakened up to some really pretty things that they've done with flavored mead.
And that's just up in Weston. It's
yeah.
one of the easier drives to a winery from Kansas City.
Yeah, there's a bunch of good wineries around here. I mean, on the Kansas side, you got Stone Pillar and Somerset Ridge and Holy Field. And on the Missouri side, you know, there's a number of wineries as well. I really think it's a lot of fun to go and do one of those. It doesn't have to be a day trip, a trip.
And just remind us, what is mead again?
Mead is an alcohol beverage made from fermented honey. So you basically collect the honey, water it down, let the yeast do what they do. And this is an ancient beverage. We're not even sure how old it is, but it's at least 3,000 years old in all likelihood because human beings have always shown a great deal of resourcefulness when it comes to finding a way to make alcohol. We will make it out of whatever we have to. I've had alcohol made from palm sap. I think the worst alcohol I've ever had in my life is one made from fermented mare's milk. It's very popular in Mongolia. Mongolia and Central Asia. Had it once. I'm good.
Yeah.
I'm good.
Right.
Done with that.
You can say you've done it.
No more cumis.
Well, so mead may not be wine, but when you're in the mood for wine, you may also want to drink mead.
Oh,
it's
I think
you drink
I
at
think
the Renaissance Fair.
Yeah, I think people would very much enjoy it who are wine drinkers.
All right. So we tasted the Shiraz a moment ago, the Syrah, and now we've got our Missouri equivalent, right? What do we have here?
Yes, we have Montel Norton, and this is, I wouldn't say this is like Shiraz, but I'd say once again, I really wanted to say, let's challenge this Norton. I think Montel and its sister winery, Augusta, Augusta Winery. They're both run by the same really brilliant winemaker, Tony Kuyumjin, who is one of the leading lights in the state. There are people like Tony or David Johnston from Stonehill who have been making great wine here for decades now. And it's just in the last, I would argue, just in the last 5 or 10 years that the world's sort of wakened up. But if you ask, honestly, if you ask a California winemaker who's been around any time at all and who stays aware of what's going on in the rest of the country, and you said Missouri, they would say, oh, you mean like Stonehill? Oh, you mean like Montel? Oh, you mean like Augusta? They're well aware of what's happening here and quite impressed with it. It's often the populace that lives here that has the inferiority complex when it comes to our wines.
Right. And that's, I think that's a very fair critique. It's more our problem than other people's problem a lot of times. What are the marks of a good Norton?
Norton is a beast. Okay. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people who try to make Norton and actually do quite a good job of it, making what we would call a claret style or a sort of old school Bordeaux, soft and elegant. But truthfully, I think Norton's a beast and it just wants to be a beast and you should just get out of the way. It's a bit like sometimes Zinfandel can be or a Petite Syrah. But I should let the tasters speak.
All right. So we're drinking a beast of a grape, this Norton from what's the name of the winery?
Montel.
Montel. Danny, you look reflective about this Norton.
I actually became a fan of Norton when Doug brought it on the show one time. And since then, I have adored this grape. Absolutely. And this is just on the nose, fabulous, so complex. It's one of those wines I find a lot of people either they hate it or they love it. And I happen to be on the love side of things here. It is so distinctive, you will never mistake it for another wine. If you've not tried it, you absolutely should. I cannot recommend it highly enough. For the complexity on the nose, for the flavor, for the finish, it just is the most distinctive grape that I can think of that I've ever had that's American.
Interesting. Lisa, you're... Yeah, I see a little bit of shrugging, and I feel like I should disclose to our listeners that yesterday in the newsroom, Lisa declared that she is really more a fan of the old world wines. So
being a snob.
Well, you didn't say it in quite that tone, but so here you are drinking the Norton. What do you think?
I like it. I on the nose, I feel like there was a lot. It was a little bit more dirty, I love a dirty wine.
Wow, it really comes out here today,
doesn't
it? Yeah,
I know. I feel like we're learning a lot about everybody.
Yeah.
But you like that about it.
I do. I do. And Norton is something that I have only ever tasted here on air in the studio.
All right. David Falk, you are you're weighing this Norton against others you've tasted.
Well, I was expecting a more tannin flavor based on the smell I got. And it wasn't there, and it surprised me. I don't know if it's a more mellow or at first I wanted to say flat, but that's probably not fair. But there's not that typical wine taste to this.
You know, I have to totally agree with you. It's the one of the Achilles heels to these hybrid grapes that we work with here in the Midwest is that the red wines don't have tannin. And that tannin, most people, I mean, it's a silly word, but we're really just describing a sort of bitter, dusty astringency that comes from the grape skins and sometimes from the seeds. And most people, if you drink tea, you would know tannin because if you leave the tea bag in the hot water too long, it gets tannic. That bitter, dusty astringency means you've leached too much tannin out of those tea leaves. Same thing can happen with grape wine. But in general, Norton's the only red grape that we have right now that we can grow in the Midwest, at least amongst these what we call hybrid grapes, that has a little bit of tannin, but it smells like it has more. And there's a lot of experimentation right now about how can we build up a little more tannin to the wine. And it also speaks to another Achilles heel to some of these wines, which is I wouldn't put any of these wines that we're growing in the Midwest just yet in the basement for a long time. Now, I do so myself as an experiment, and Norton's about the only red that seems to survive 10 or 20 years in the basement.
But I know people who don't like wine because of that tannin taste, and this would be worth their trying because Mm-hmm. Yes, quite it would be a nice option.
There's a wine for every taster.
There we go.
We had someone write to us on Twitter, Carolyn Anderson. She says, I'm a fan of Norton by Les Bourgeois, our state grape, Carolyn calls it. She asks, Doug, what are your thoughts on this bold wine? And she raises a particular winery, Les Bourgeois. Does it? Are we going to get very different wines, even with the same grape, here in Missouri?
Yeah, I think we are. Les Bourgeois makes really nice Norton. They make they're one of those wineries. If you haven't visited the winery, it sits on the bluffs above the Missouri River, watching sunset from there. I think is a rite of passage for all MU grads.
Been there, done it.
Yeah, and it's pretty, and they make pretty wonderful wines too. The winemakers there. Jacob and Corey are pretty sharp cats, and but their style is a little bit different. I think Montel tends to occupy a sort of kind of, you know, if you will, a sort of Shiraz, Syrah range of full-bodied, big, expansive, not over-oaked, but not necessarily trying to be as elegant as Les Bourgeois tends to be, I think, a little bit leaner, a little more refined. But, you know, that's just my palate talking. Everybody's going to approach these things and have a slightly different view of each.
You know, we've mentioned Pirtle Winery in Weston. We've mentioned Les Bourgeois there in Boonville. Are there any other wineries that you would especially say, you know, worth a day trip, worth driving over to check it out? The experience of the winery, not just the wine itself, but the experience is worth it.
Yeah, I certainly, you know, I mentioned Les Bourgeois, which is close by, just outside Columbia. I mentioned some Kansas wineries like Somerset Ridge and Holy Field and Stone Pillar that I think, and Blue Jacket Crossing that do some really neat stuff. Jowler is nearby here. And there's some others. I feel awful. I'm blanking out on them right now. But there's some folks nearby that do some pretty remarkable work. So I think it's a fun thing to do. When you go in, if you don't like a wine, tell them and say, oh, this isn't exactly my style. Do you have something else? Because they make differing styles because they know people like differing styles.
Let's take one call here from Jake in Kansas City. Jake, welcome to Up to Date.
Well, thank you, sir, and a pleasant good morning to all. One thing I thought of on the short hold I had, do you guys make your own cuvées or anything? Take a jug wine, a table wine or something, and, you know, mix it with an ounce or two of something that's a little further up the food chain to make a different creature.
Well, and that's a somewhat different question, but Doug, worth doing?
Well, you know, it's a fun question because the truth of the matter is that there's no reason that you can't. What I would say is that in the case of a number of wineries around the country, there are people who will buy what we would call juice or wine from, say, Washington State or New York State or California, and blend a little bit into their wines in other regions. And this is done in Missouri, and this is done in Kansas and many other places to make the wine better. Also, in some ways, to stretch out what they have. You know, there are a lot of different reasons why they might do it. And if they can do it, why couldn't a consumer do it? And the answer I would give you...
Yeah, right on, brother.
Yeah, exactly. The answer I would give you, though, in truth, is
Ben,
that...
You know, people look at me oddly, and I say, well, I think, you know, the wine people do it, and I find it to be, you know, effective and tasteful. And, of course, my palate, if it tastes like grapes, I say, this is a pretty nice wine.
I'd have to say is that it's really funny because I've done a lot of blending, and 2 + 2 never equals 4. And so that's the great vision that most winemakers have, is they're able to say, if I put this together and this together, it may seem like both those characteristics will be retained, but flavor is a very complex thing. And so when you think that I'll put them together and I'll still have them both, one of them usually gets sort of crunched in the process.
Well, Jake, I appreciate the call. We've got just a few minutes left here and only one wine to go. So, Doug, what are we drinking now?
Well, we're having decided to step it up. We're having a Brunello di Montalcino, which is a certainly, I think most people would regard, the greatest of all wines from Tuscany. This is a 2006, which is a great vintage in Brunello. I wanted to put it in perspective. This is from Val di Suga, a really lovely winery there in Brunello di Montalcino. Brunello is the name of the grape, but it's the same grape that we would call Sangiovese, used to make Chianti, used to make this wine.
I may not spit this one, actually. I'm going to go ahead and just admit. quick responses to this wine. Danny?
I can see what you mean by the tannin that you were waiting to show me. So it's there. It has a very unique note on the nose. I can't identify it, but maybe you can for us. There's just one, and because David and I both kind of went like this and looked at each other and were like, can't quite name it, but it has a very distinct note. It was, of the three, as great as it is, and it's a nice wine, not my favorite.
It's very, very tannic.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and Lisa? This is more up your alley we've established.
Mm-hmm. This is my favorite. I like it. And I think that on the nose, you smell that this has a bit more age than the other wines that we've been drinking. It's a 2006, which I think is the oldest that we've had today. But yeah, I love it.
David, your thoughts? Tell us the name again. I'm sorry, David. The name of the wine, the winery?
Don't ask me to say it.
Yeah, it's called Val di Suga, right. And it's their Brunello di Montalcino. It's a vineyard designate called Vigna Spontali, 2006.
Got all that. Okay.
Tannins ever present. But what's interesting to me about this is the color.
Mm-hmm. As they age, they get lighter, don't they? Usually,
yes, they do. Yeah. Color starts to fade from sometimes purple in warm climate wines, certainly dark red, into something more tan, even amber as they get older.
Very good. I'm going to agree with the assessment of this wine. It's pretty fantastic. But I will also say, and I'm not one to usually advocate for Missouri wines, but I get why you served us this alongside the Norton. There is a hint of what's happening here in that Missouri grape.
Yeah, some of that so-called dirtiness that Lisa was talking about, and the aromas. Now, we could talk about what aromas you're getting here, but I think one of the aromas is going to be a sort of old cellar, old basement. You know, those barrels, the wine has been in these barrels for a long time in an old, old cellar, yeah. And there's a little bit of that smell.
Well, we have to leave it there, but I am so grateful. One of only four people in the world who is both a master of wine and a master sommelier, Doug Frost, walking us through Missouri and the rest of the world. Doug, always good to have you here.
Well, thank you. And Stonehouse Farms was that winery I was trying to think of out in Lee Summit.
Very good. And thanks also to Danny and to Lisa and to David for tasting with us today.
Cheers.
Cheers to all of you. Yes.